Exodus, please. Exodus, well, let's see. How about chapter 7 or 8, somewhere around about there? We're going to do something slightly different with Moses this evening. We're not going to actually study a portion of Scripture. I'm not going to exposit one verse or a paragraph. I know some of you are like, what? I'm going to do a portion of Scripture, which is probably going to be, I hope we're going to get at least five chapters tonight. Now you're really scratching your heads, right? My pastor's going to do five chapters in one night? I guess this is an exercise in what you've heard me call the big picture view, which we do every once in a while. We need to do it. When we get to the end, we want to see that Moses has arrived. I mean, what we're doing here, this is not a study of Exodus and the plagues and Egypt and all that kind of thing per se. It's a study of the life of Moses. How God took this guy and turned him into the powerful, greatest prophet Israel had, greatest leader Israel had, humanly speaking. What we want to see is that this 80-year-old, that sink in for a minute, this 80-year-old, I don't even qualify yet. Nat does, but I don't. Tom does. But this 80-year-old former Jewish Egyptian, note how I said that, has turned into a Jewish shepherd, and he's now the deliverer of Israel. He's finally arrived at the place where God can and will use him. That's what we want to see. And true enough, Moses will have to live with the consequences of his earlier weaknesses, but isn't that always the case with me and you as well? Sometimes there are only very mild or slight consequences to our mistakes, I use that word. Other times the consequences are huge. We try to prevent the huge consequences, especially when it comes to our children. We try and protect them and point them in the right direction, but sometimes they just don't listen. So, if you would like to follow along in your copy of the Scriptures, please, I'm going to go through these chapters, making sure that I pick out what are some pretty salient points, but for the most part, this is going to seem, and I coined a word for you. You ready? You want to write this down? Dan, where are you? Where's Dan? Okay, counting. Figures. Here's the word. Review-ish. You like that? It's going to seem review-ish. And I guess it kind of is. We will probably spend just a little bit more time toward the end with the last plague, the Passover. But believe me, we're not going to do a thorough examination of the Passover. So here we go. Ready? J. Dwight Pentecost wrote in his very famous, well-known work, Thy Kingdom Come, these words about the plagues. What we refer to as the 10 plagues were actually judgments designed to authenticate Moses as God's messenger and his message as God's message. Their ultimate purpose, the plagues, their ultimate purpose was to reveal the greatness of the power and authority of God to the Egyptians. And he says this occurs from 7:10 all the way through 12:36. In order to bring Pharaoh and the Egyptians into subjection to God. That's a pretty good quote. Each one of the plagues, I'm done with Pentecost, each one of those plagues shows the utter failure of one or more of the Egyptian gods, lowercase g. Each one of them. Every plague touched all of Egypt. Every man, woman, child, all the beasts and the crops. But not every plague, in fact most of them, touched the Israelites living in Goshen. And the Bible makes that distinction several times. We're not going to look at the verses, but it makes those distinctions. This did not reach into the land of Goshen. The plague of darkness, which is eight or nine, I think, in the list, nine, it specifically says, darkness fell over Egypt, but not Goshen. their lights still worked. Okay. None of the plagues touched the heart of Pharaoh. Not a single one. Even in the one instance where Pharaoh kind of seems like he is surrendering to the appeal of his court leaders, his heart was unchanged and his mind reverted very quickly to his original refusal to let God's people go. The authentication that Pentecost speaks of is the reason behind Pharaoh's first demand of Moses. You in chapter 7? Look at verses 9 and 10. God is telling him, Moses, when Pharaoh shall speak unto you, saying, show me a miracle for you. What that means is Pharaoh is going to say to Moses, show me a miracle to prove you who you are, what you say. Then thou shalt say to Aaron, take thy rod. This is chapter 7, verse 9. Take thy rod, cast it before Pharaoh, and it shall become a serpent. And Moses and Aaron went in unto Pharaoh, and they did so as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. Moses begins his encounters with Pharaoh with a simple, or is any miracle simple? I understand that I misspoke this morning. I told you all scripture reading was going to be Philippians chapter 3. That was correct. And so then apparently just before I started to read, did I really say Ephesians 3? You've been vindicated. I'll tell you what. I just do not remember that. You've never done that, have you, Nat? And that's my friend. Moses begins with simply with a miracle, not a plague. This is a miracle that would have or should have shown Pharaoh who was really in command, especially when the Egyptians duplicate the miracle, but Moses' snake consumes their snakes. I mean, really, Pharaoh? Any rational man would have realized something along these lines. This isn't just some plain old ordinary court wise man or even a normal shepherd. Another scholar wrote this about this incident. The point of this brief section is that Yahweh's proof of his powerful presence to the Pharaoh and thus to the Pharaoh's Egypt will be miraculous in nature. In other words, this start of miracles is the start of miracles. And at the end, I'll make a statement about how many there are and a few things. But Pharaoh, since you have refused, Yahweh's deliverance will be miraculous and you will see it. Thus, Moses will be used by God to introduce Pharaoh to God and God's judgment of Egypt for his leadership or lack of leadership. In chapter 7, verses 14 through 18, I'm not going to read them. You're going to just glance at them. Moses announces the first plague on the Nile River, and it turns to blood. We call this the plague of blood. The wells also were poisoned, and the streams were poisoned, all of it. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 15, we have the plague of the frogs, the second plagues. The frogs are followed by gnats. Your text will say flies or lice. Chapter 8, 16 through 19 cover this third plague, the judgment of the gnats. The Hebrew word that's translated lice, when you look it up in the Hebrew dictionary, the lexicon, it has one word, one single word. It's not like shalom with a whole paragraph of things. It has one word, gnats. These are gnats. You know how they are, the equivalent of North Carolina mayflies. Some seasons the mayflies are, you know, endurable, and others they'll drive you crazy, won't they? Gnats. Can you imagine them everywhere? In chapter 8, verses 24 through 32, the fourth plague is similar but different. Our King James Bible says flies. However, the Hebrew word again has one meaning, basically swarms. But the Bible doesn't tell us swarms of what? Really, this is the plague of swarms. The word flies in your King James is italicized. the King James interpreters have entered that in there to help us understand it. The problem is, for the Egyptian anyway, is that this is a lot of insects. There are a lot of insects that swarm. The problem for our understanding is the common American housefly is not one that swarms. These are not flies. These are swarming insects. Swindoll wrote that the Hebrew word for swarm means mixture, speaking of a great mixture of different kinds of insects. Big flying beetles, spiders dropping off the ceiling, fleas hopping all over you, ticks burrowing into your skin, tiny chiggers crawling under your clothing, bees stinging you. They weren't honeybees. One thing about Swindoll is he can write. Can you imagine swarming insects? Chapter 9, verses 1 through 7 describe the fifth plague, the plague of the livestock. Egyptian livestock, not Jewish livestock, not Israel's. Verses 8 through 12 tell us about the sixth plague, the plague of the boils. This is the first one that attacks the Egyptians physically speaking. It's also a bit of a turning point. And we're not going to take the time to read the passage between 9, 13, and 17, where the Lord uses that to introduce the seventh plague. The plague of hail and fire is in 18 through 25. And this seventh plague brings the first potential crack in the stubborn heart of a stubborn Pharaoh. Look at verse 27 of chapter 9. Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said unto them, you almost can't believe it. I have sinned this time. And I want to go, oh, just this time? The Lord is righteous and I and my people are wicked. Entreat the Lord, for it is enough that there be no more mighty thunderings and hail, and I will let you go and you shall stay no longer. Now, pause. The purpose of our study is the life of Moses, the growth of Moses, the servant of God. And here we see our first really good piece of evidence, it's a little subtle, that Moses has sharpened his wits. Moses is doing much better. Moses is not fooled by Pharaoh's statement. Look at verse 29. Moses said unto Pharaoh, as soon as I am gone out of the city, I will spread abroad my hands unto the Lord, and the thunder shall cease. Neither shall there be any more hail, that you may know how that the earth is the Lord's. Here's the statement. But as for thee and thy servants, I know that you will not yet fear the Lord God. See, Moses is not fooled by Pharaoh's faux confession. That sign of weakening in Pharaoh, almost as soon as Moses is out of the room, I could just see his heart getting hard. Chapter 9 closes with the confirmation that Moses was right and Pharaoh was lying. Look at verse 34. Chapter 9, verse 34. When Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunders were ceased, he sinned yet more and hardened his heart, he and his servants. Don't go getting the idea the entire court was against Pharaoh. They hardened their hearts too. And the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, neither would he let the children of Israel go as the Lord had spoken by Moses. All right. Now let's pause for a minute and take an assessment of Moses. It's a good spot to do that before we continue our historical survey. What have we not seen so far in what we've looked at from Moses that we had been seeing in the past? First off, there's no resistance from Moses, is there, to doing what God tells him to do. There are no arguments from Moses, no questions, no challenges, no, well, what will they say? None of those. There's no hesitation in going into conflict with Pharaoh. He just walks right up to Pharaoh and confronts him. There's no flinching on his part when Pharaoh refuses. And there is an obvious growing in his faith in Yahweh. Everything Yahweh has told Moses would happen has happened. I would suggest that based on Moses' prior education in Egypt, remember those years 40 years ago? That Moses has already in his mind, text never tells us this, but I would guess because Moses is a smart man, he has already figured out what God is doing. I think Moses knows that God is slowly and methodically eliminating each and every false Egyptian god one at a time from that Egyptian pantheon of false gods. I wouldn't be surprised if Moses is already able to look ahead and figure out that the last and the final false god to be defeated will be Pharaoh himself. Isn't that what the plague of death, the Passover, is all about? What is Moses showing the people of Israel through all of this? They're watching him. They're watching their leader. Anybody here know who the President of the United States is? Are you paying attention? Are you watching? Well, of course we are. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter which party the president's from in this country. We always watch our leaders. We watch them lie and cheat and steal. I'm sorry. What's Moses showing the people right now? He is showing them that trust in those false gods that they have all grown up with, that they have lived among all their lives, is absolutely pointless. Moses is going to have to tell these people in a few weeks here some absolutely incredible things that they're going to have to do to prepare to leave Egypt. Things they've never done before. Look at those when we get to the last plague. These people who are listening to Moses have never met with Yahweh. They had no burning bush experience. They did not spend time on the mountain with the God of the universe. They've not spoken to Yahweh and had a conversation back and forth like Moses has. They haven't done any of that. They, in fact, have been living, we've said this, we all know this, Egypt is a picture of the world in the Bible. Go down to Egypt, go down to the world. They've lived in the world for 400 years. Not all of them, obviously. They've died and more have been born. But that's all they have known. They've not met Yahweh. So Moses is the one who will have to, and put this in quote, Moses will have to convince them. I'm from Yahweh. I'm from the one true God. Aaron and I are his representatives. You've got to listen to me. Do you now see why Moses was so concerned about that little matter of, but what if they won't listen to me? Remember that question he asked God? Now you understand a little more why. The result here of all this is that I don't think that this Moses is the same Moses who entered Egypt. I don't think this is the same Moses. And if you want to gain confidence in God right now in your life right here, do something for him. If you want to gain confidence in God, do something for him. I came across this saying that I'm going to give you somewhere this week. I don't remember where, which doesn't surprise me. What does surprise me is I remembered the saying. Calm seas do not make capable sailors. Calm seas do not make capable sailors. Why do we seem to think that we can accomplish things for the Lord with the minimum of effort or even failure? Why do we seem to think we can accomplish things for the Lord but not have any pain on our part? Take this summer. We did 4 ministries this summer. There was a lot of work and sweat and pain that went into those things. But isn't that the point in a believer's life where he's really ready to be used by the Lord? Where he's finally emptied himself of himself and he's now ready to be used by God. What did Paul write to the Corinthians in chapter 12? I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. And we read in Philippians a couple of Sundays back, for it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. No, this is not the same Moses that entered Egypt a few months earlier. Not at all. And that leads us to plague number 8, the plague of locusts. One of the things that should be obvious here is the Egyptians are slowly beginning to be starved to death. We haven't looked at all the plagues and all the impacts of them, but their crops are being destroyed, their livestock is being destroyed, their Walmart shelves in the food department are going empty. It's worse than a supply chain crisis. This is an actual possession. It's being destroyed before their very eyes. And their Pharaoh, their God leader, is superintending this destruction. So I have to ask you, do you see the irony? Who prevented their starvation 400 years earlier? A Jewish man named Joseph. Yep. Do you see the irony? Now Joseph's descendants, Moses in particular, are the instrument of the Egyptian starvation 400 years later. Ninth plague, the plague of darkness. Chapter 10, verse 21 through 27 covers this plague. It is brief in its description and it's brief in its duration, 3 days. Some have tried to explain this away as a celestial event. But let me ask you, the last time we saw a solar eclipse was what, 5 or 6 years ago, something like that? During the daytime, I remember I made one of those tubes with a piece of paper. That was kind of cool, right? Where you could see it, look on the paper. How long did it last? Total eclipse time is what, 3 minutes usually? Something like that. If you're so blessed as to see the what they call the diamond ring thing, you know. This is 3 days, not 3 minutes. Another scholar tried to explain it away as some kind of electrical interference in the atmosphere that caused all the dust to rise up and block out the sun. I love it when they try to make human explanations for God's supernatural power. It's nonsense. This plague is just like all the other plagues. God has stepped into his created natural world and done a supernatural thing. Accept the just and have a good attitude. Chapter 10 closes with about the only true statement that Pharaoh utters in this entire mess. Chapter 10, verse 28. Pharaoh said to Moses, I put Moses in place of the pronoun, get thee from me. Take heed to yourself. Watch out, you. See my face no more. For in that day thou seest my face, thou shalt die. Moses said, yep, I agree, Pharaoh, you spoke well. I will see thy face again no more. Wow. And he doesn't. Now, the climax of the contest with Pharaoh. You know, it's not even a fair contest, right? Okay. God will prove in a truly amazing and dreadfully awful way that he is the one true God. And the final plague will destroy this final false god of Egypt. All the other ones have been wiped out. The final false god is Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh will not be able to save his own son, his firstborn son, who would have been his successor, another false god in the making. There are a great number of applications that could be made about this contest between Pharaoh and his kingdom and God and his chosen people. They're going to be for other messages. I've done some in the past. We'll do some in the future one day. We're looking at Moses, seeing him grow in the Lord, strengthen his faith, gain mastery over his personal shortcomings, so that we can learn from this servant. Anyone here have no shortcomings? Okay, that's good. This final plague, the last chapter in the saga here, will require for the first time the participation of all the people. Their willing obedience to Moses' instructions and a huge step of faith on their part. See, up to this point, all the Israelites have been watching. They've been watching. They've been watching Moses. They've been watching their taskmasters suffer. They've been watching the Pharaoh lead his people to destruction. They've been watching the destruction of the Egyptians' land, the Egyptians' crops, the Egyptians' beasts and cattle, not their own. They have been mere spectators in all this so long. Don't be a spectator in a local church, by the way. That was free. Up to this point, they have been watching. Now they're going to have to do some doing. I mentioned a bit ago, Moses would have to tell the people to do some things they'd never heard of and they'd certainly never done before. That's going to require two things, obedience and faith. So, chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. God tells Moses, "The Lord said unto Moses, yet will I bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go. When he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out hence altogether." In other words, going to give him the boot. Boom! Get out of here. Had enough of you. Verse 2. "Speak now in the ears of the people, and let every man borrow of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor jewels of silver, jewels of gold." We often view this as God finally paying the wages of 300 plus years of servitude. If that's all this is, it's a pretty meager wage. I used to tell my history students, you want to get a grasp on how long something is or how short something is, compare it to the history of the country you live in. How old is this country? 246 years? 5 years? They've been in captivity longer than the United States of America has been a country. That gives you a little perspective. That's a pretty long time. Look what the colonists built. The richest, most powerful country the world has ever seen in 245 years. That's all it took. Literally worth hundreds of trillions of dollars, right? What is the national worth of this country? I know what the national debt is, $30 trillion. What is the net worth of our country? The value of goods and services and products and things we've produced in those 245 years? You know, Egypt wouldn't come close to paying their salaries for 300 years. No way. Not even in 1445 BC money. Wouldn't happen. No, God has a different plan. God has a plan for a large portion of what the Israelites will spoil from the Egyptians. But here's the interesting part. He doesn't tell them. Do you realize not even the leader Moses knows what this is for? Moses doesn't know. The people don't know. Just take everything they give you, and they're going to give you everything because they can't wait to be rid of you. Just obey, spoil the Egyptians. And even better than that, look at verse 3 in chapter 11. "The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians." That means they gave them everything they could. Then this statement, moreover, or even more than that, or even better, "The man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people." Big picture again, remember? When Moses left Egypt 40 years earlier, how did he go? He ran for his life. the respect and the esteem that Moses wanted 40 years ago because he was going to deliver his people, when he got ahead of God, that didn't work out for him, now he's getting it. It's all about God's time, not Moses' time. The respect that he sought 40 years ago, now God allows him to have it. Now, because Moses has grown in his strength and his faith, now Moses is capable of handling that admiration. And it's from the Egyptians. It's implied from his own people as well, because they listened to what he told them to do. Moses is now capable. This brand new nation of Israel, and this will be the beginning of their calendar when they leave, will leave with the wealth of the Egyptians, and Moses will leave with the respect of the Egyptians and his own people. Now, look at the rest of the chapter with me. I love Sunday night because I don't care what the clock says, and I have more time on Sunday night. So look at the rest of the chapter. Look at verse 4 of chapter 11. You got the right chapter and verse, honey? I do. Okay. Moses said, "Thus saith the Lord, about midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn of the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sits upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant that's behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beasts. And there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there was none like it, nor shall be like it any more. But against the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue, against man or beast." No barking. "That you may know how that the Lord doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. And all these thy servants shall come down unto thee and bow down themselves unto me, saying, Get thee out, and all the people that follow thee. And after that, I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in a great anger. And the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land. And Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart." Remember, after Pharaoh hardened his own heart many times, so that he would not let the children of Israel go out of his land. This is the last plague. This is the tenth, the Passover, or the plague of death. And these words were spoken by Moses to Pharaoh, most likely just after Pharaoh had said to Moses, "I won't see your face anymore," back in chapter 10, verse 28. You have to remember, when we read these Old Testament narratives, sometimes you can't read them chronologically straight through. Chapter 12 is actually a parenthetical chapter. It gives all these details about Passover. Five things Moses pointed out. Something's going to happen at midnight, Pharaoh. All of Egypt's firstborn will die, animals too. There will be a national distress. Israel will be protected as usual, and Israel will go out. Now I want to read verse 8 to you again, out of the NASB. "All these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying," this is before Moses, "Go out, you and all the people who follow you. And after that, I will go out." And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Do you see what I mean? That this Moses isn't the same Moses who arrived months ago. He's not the same guy. This is spoken with all the confidence of a leader who walks with God, who speaks with and listens to God. The Bible tells us later that Moses met with God face to face. Now, that's a Hebrew idiom, but it doesn't say that about anybody else. This is a man in whom the former arrogance is gone, but the strong God-given authority is there. And that's important. When Moses utters that final word, out, he turns and he walks out. It's a Hebrew play on words there. It catches a Hebrew reader's attention. Truth is, this is God's message. And when God's man speaks God's message, it carries all the authority of God himself. How about all those prophets we read about in the later pages of the Old Testament? What's the formula that we hear? Thus saith the Lord. When you see that formula, that Hebrew formula, it's a true prophet of God. There are a few false prophets who say, well, God said X, Y, Z, and that formula is not there. And the ultimate divine author of Scripture made sure that that formula is there for us to see that when God's man speaks, it's like God is speaking. And when God's man, when a man is speaking and it's not God's man, you'll know it. This is how. Those words are not there. Chapter 12, as I mentioned, is parenthetical. It's a detailed set of instructions that Moses is to deliver to the people of Israel. And it's not our purpose to look at those. They're very specific. They're very detailed. You've already heard about everything they had to do. Instead, think about what you already know in chapter 12. Think about it from this perspective. Moses is giving them something to do they've never even heard of before, let alone done. They have never roasted a lamb like he's telling them to roast that lamb. They've never eaten with their sandals on, their staffs in their hand, and their travel clothes on, ready to go. That's chapter 12, verse 11. They've never caught the blood from the slain animal in a pan, and they've certainly never put it on the doorpost and the lintel of their door. Why would they ever do such a thing? In fact, none of them had ever been out of Egypt. Most of them had probably never been out of Goshen. If you had been one of the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, what would you have thought when you got these kinds of instructions? Well, let me tell you. Sometimes God asks us to step out, to step up, or to do something for him, and he just doesn't give us all that we'd like to know. He just doesn't do it. He doesn't answer all of our questions. Truth is, he rarely does answer most of our questions. If he did, following him would not be an exercise in what? Faith. Well-taught class. See, God simply wants us to obey. Moses has been in this very place before, even though God did allow Moses to ask some questions. God didn't give Moses all the answers he wanted, did he? In fact, God didn't give Moses very many of the answers he wanted. As Moses was going through the doors, God was supplying what he needed to know. It's an as-need basis kind of thing. God didn't tell Moses, okay, Moses, this is how I'm going to bring my people out. You're going to make 8 demands. There will be 10 plagues. There will be 12 miracles, give or take one or two. There will be 4 compromises that that Pharaoh will renege on, and the big finale will be a real killer. God never gave Moses that. God didn't tell Moses the plagues are designed to destroy all the Egyptian pantheon of false gods so the people will know that I am the one true God. I've mentioned before, God didn't tell me I was going to be a pastor when we moved down here. He didn't do that until about 2012. It's not that I was a slow learner, although I am. It's that he just didn't tell me that yet. You know why? I didn't need to know it yet. We made our plans. I've told you this for my education, but God didn't tell us he'd wipe all that out and then he'd use his people to pave the way for us. He didn't tell us that. Why? Because God knew that I needed to learn a new level of faith, one that I had not been exercised in before. So did Moses. And now Moses is going to teach his people that very same lesson. But some folks just won't learn, will they? Pharaoh didn't learn. One writer said, and I'm paraphrasing, the nation made history while Pharaoh became history. God didn't call Moses or the people to understand his will, just to obey his will. And when we are obedient to God's call, the doors just seem to fly open. I've experienced it. There are a number of people in this auditorium, in our church family, who've given their entire lives to service of the Lord, and they would witness to the identical same thing that I just said. When you are walking with the Lord and you are in His will and you are stepping in faith, the doors fly open. And if you push on a door that you think is supposed to fly open and it won't budge, push on another one, because when you get to the right one, it's going to fly open and you're going to know it. You don't always know God's will. Pastor, how do I know God's will? I don't know. It's different for every individual. The Lord works in your heart. He uses other godly people. He uses His word. He uses your prayers and other people's prayers for you. It's a process. It's not an instantaneous thing. It wasn't with Moses. I don't know how long it has been since the burning bush, but my guess would be, considering how travel and all went in those days, it's probably getting close to a year before they finally exit Egypt. Moses had to learn how to follow God's will, how to understand what God wanted. People have to learn that too. And we're going to see, if we continue with Moses, we're going to see that the people, they're not very good learners. They make one mistake after the other. And then we're going to see that even though I think Moses has finally arrived, he has flourished into the man that God can and will use. He's learned many lessons. He's not yet perfect, and he never will be. He's going to make more mistakes. And he's going to make one mistake in particular that's going to be especially egregious, and he's going to pay a humongous price for it. That's a technical theological word, humongous. He's really going to pay a price for striking that rock the second time. But right here, in this time and in this place, Moses has risen to the occasion. Moses has arrived. And for us, me and you, we must be willing. We must be obedient. We must begin the journey of faith. Is God calling you to do something? I don't know. Simple thing, speak to someone about Jesus. Accept a responsibility here in the local church. Join a local church. Are you ready to follow God in faith without getting all your questions answered first?